civilians were stick figures wearing the ragged summer uniforms in which they'd been captured years before. Stacked against a wall were dozens of boxes, some of which had spilled gray ash to the floor. These were the cremated remains of 60 POWs, one in every five who died here, most from relentless physical abuse. Of the many hells Louis had known in war, this would be the worst. Nowetsu was almost lethally cold. Each night of shivering ended before dawn, when Louis was forced outside for roll call in deep snow and howling wind. By day he huddled with Tinker and Wade, fighting worsening diarrhea and fever. The Nowetsu rations, mostly seaweed, didn't help him. Because all the guards smoked American cigarettes, the prisoners knew the Red Cross was sending relief boxes. The POWs got nothing. Louis' transfer back to the Bird was no coincidence. Watanabe, whom the Aussies called What a Bastard, had hand-picked him, almost certainly to torment him. Almost the moment Louis walked into camp, the Bird was on him. Louis took his beatings with defiance, provoking the Bird to ever more violent attacks. He descended back into a state of profound stress. And yet, Louis was lucky. Nowetsu was a war production village, and the enlisted POWs were its slaves. Each day they were marched to factories, a steel mill, and barges, doing dangerous, back-breaking labor in shifts of some 18 hours. At the shift's ends, Louis saw men rambling in, some so exhausted they had to be carried. The Japanese literally worked men to death at Nowetsu. Louis had much to bear, but because he was an officer, at least he didn't have that. Winter faded, the snow melted. A pig appeared. All winter, he'd been living in a snow cavern, sustained by food dropped to him by an Australian. Louis looked at him in wonder. The animal's skin had become see-through. When the ground thawed, the Bird announced he was sending the officers to a farm to labor. Though this violated the Geneva Convention, Fitzgerald knew it would keep his officers away from the Bird and couldn't be anything like the killing labor done by the enlisted men. He raised no protest. Each morning, Louis and the other officers assembled, attended by a guard, Ogawa. They loaded a cart with benjo waste, used as fertilizer, yoked themselves to it, and pulled it to the farm, sometimes darting away to steal vegetables from fields while Ogawa's back was turned. The 6-mile walk was tiring, but the work, tending potatoes, was easy, and Ogawa was placid. And because they were working, the officers were granted full rations. Though rations were dwindling as Japan's fortunes fell, a full bowl of seaweed was better than half a bowl of seaweed. April 13th was a bright day, the land bathed in sunshine, the sky wide and clear. Louis and the other officers were scattered over the farm working, when the field suddenly went still, and the men turned up their faces. At the same moment, all over Nowetsu, POWs and Japanese gazed up. High overhead, something was winking in the sunlight, white ribbons unfurling behind it. It was a B-29, the first to cross over Nowetsu. Followed by innumerable eyes, the plane made a lonely arc from one horizon to the other. It dropped no bombs, but its appearance showed how far over Japan the Americans were venturing and how little resistance the Japanese could offer. The POWs were elated. The Japanese were unnerved. None more than the Bird. A few days later, Ogawa teased Watanabe about his lazy laborers. He meant no harm, but the remark sent the bird into a fury. He shouted for the farm workers to line up, then stormed and frothed, thoroughly deranged. Finally, he screamed his punishment. From now on, all officers would do hard labor on coal barges. If they refused, he'd execute every one of them. One look at the bird told Fitzgerald this was an order he couldn't fight. The next morning, as the officers were marched into slavery, the bird watched. He was smiling. The officers were taken to the river and crowded onto a barge heaped with coal. Six were given shovels. Louis and the rest had large baskets strapped to their backs. On the guard's orders, the shovelers began heaving coal into the baskets. A cubic foot of coal can weigh as much as 60 pounds, so the bearers were soon staggering. With the guards screaming at them, they were hounded off the barge and up the riverbank to a rail car, where they wobbled up a narrow ramp, dumped the coal, and returned to have their baskets refilled. All day the men labored. By the time they were allowed to stop, they were utterly spent. By Wade's estimate, each basket bearer had carried well over 4 tons of coal. So began a daily routine. Each time the men finished one barge, another arrived. Then one day they were loaded onto an empty barge and taken into the Sea of Japan. The barge drew alongside a coal ship, the sea heaving, water spraying over the deck. A guard gestured to a net slung over the side of the ship. "Jump onto the net," he said. "Then climb to the deck." The POWs were appalled. The two vessels were crashing together and rolling apart, and the net was a rapidly moving target. The men balked, but the guards forced them forward, and POWs began jumping. Louis, terrified, sprang across and climbed clear. He was hustled into the ship's hold, to a giant dome of coal beside a large hanging net. He was given a shovel, and the guards were suddenly teeming around him, cracking him with clubs. Hour after hour, Louis stooped over his shovel in a swirl of shouting guards and black dust, heaving coal into the net. At last, at day's end, the work was halted. The POWs were so caked in coal that they were indistinguishable. Every morning, the men were sent to their shovels again. Every night, they dragged back to the barracks, black ghosts trudging in and falling onto their bunks, weary to their bones, spitting black saliva. Occasionally, Louis was switched from coal to industrial salt. The work was just as taxing, and the salt liquefied in his sweat and ran down his back, burning cracks in his skin. Tragedy was inevitable. One day, as Louis stood on the barge awaiting his jump to the ship, the man ahead mistimed his leap. Crushed between the vessels, he crumpled onto the barge. The guards hardly paused, pushing Louis to step past the man and jump. Louis never learned whether the man survived. Slavery swallowed men's souls, but the POWs scored little victories. On the barges, they'd sneak to the galleys and stuff food into their clothes. The guards' lunchboxes kept vanishing, and overseer's cigarettes, set down as he turned away, were gone when he turned back. The POWs stole anything they could, risking their necks for something as trivial as a pencil box. The box itself was nothing. The theft of it, a tiny act of defiance, was everything. In the Benjo one day, Louis noticed something blocking a knothole in the wall. Looking closer, he realized it was a rice sack in a storage room on the other side of the wall. Remembering the Omori sugar thieves, he searched camp, found a hollow reed, and sharpened the end. That night, He donned his camp-issued pajamas, fitted with ankle strings. He tied the strings tight, headed into the banjo, jammed one end of the reed through the knothole, piercing the rice sack, then put the other end into his pajamas. Rice streamed through the reed and into his pants. Louis left the banjo moving as naturally as he could with 10 pounds of rice in his pajamas. He strolled past the guards and into the barracks, where Fitzgerald waited, a blanket spread before him. Louis stepped on the blanket, untied his ankle strings, and let the rice spill out. Fitzgerald quickly folded the blanket, then hid the rice in socks and compartments he'd made in the walls. When the guards left the building, Louis and Fitzgerald rushed the rice to the heating stove, boiled it, and shared it with other POWs. In Naoetsu's POW insurgency, perhaps the greatest feat was pulled off by Ken Marvin, a Marine captured at Wake. When Marvin's one-eyed slave guard, Bad Eye, asked Marvin to teach him his language, Marvin began teaching Bad Eye catastrophically bad English. From that day forward, when asked, "How are you?" Bad Eye would smilingly reply, "What the fuck do you care?" Disaster struck Louis in April. He was lugging a load of salt up the railcar ramp when a guard started walking down. The guard threw out his elbow, sending Louis tumbling off the ramp. Landing feet first, Louis felt a tearing sensation, then scorching pain in his ankle and knee. Louis couldn't walk. He hopped back to camp and was removed from salt duty. He would now be the only officer trapped in camp with the bird all day, and his rations would be halved. Louis lay in the barracks, ravenous, crippled by his injured leg, diarrhea, and a 104-degree fever. To get his rations restored, he had to find work he could do on one leg. Desperate, he begged the bird for work. The bird savored his plea. From now on, he said, Louis would care for the pig. He'd get full rations, but there was a catch. He'd have to use his bare hands to clean the sty. Emaciated and seriously ill, Louis was condemned to crawl on the ground, picking up feces and cramming handfuls of the pig's feed into his mouth to save himself from starving to death. If anything's going to shatter me, Louis thought, this is it. Chapter 29 220 Punches. On May 5, 1945, the growl of four huge engines echoed over Naoetsu. A B-29 was circling the steel mill. Sirens sounded, but in the mill, the foreman kept the POWs working. There was a sudden, massive crash, and it began snowing very hard inside the mill. It wasn't snow, but dust falling from the rafters. The Japanese fled. The panicked POWs crowded together, praying they wouldn't get hit. The bombs missed, blowing gaping craters in a field nearby. But for the POWs, there was much more to this raid than holes in the ground. If the Americans were attacking a lone steel mill in a place as obscure as Naoetsu, did this mean they had already destroyed the big strategic cities? The answer came 10 days later, when 400 new POWs shuffled through the gates. The bird delivered his standard harangue. "You must be sincere. You must work for earnest. You must obey. I have spoken." "Who the hell is Ernest?" muttered a POW. The new men said they'd come from slave camps in the vast war production cities of Kobe and Osaka. Weeks before, B-29s had swept over the cities in 300 plane swarms, showering them in firebombs. Of no use to Japan in razed cities, the POWs had been shipped to Naoetsu to continue slaving for the empire. The new men had one other piece of news. Germany had fallen. The whole weight of the Allies was now thrown against Japan. By June, Louis's leg was healed enough for him to walk, and he was sent back to slavery. He was growing sicker. When he begged for rest while burning with a 103-degree fever, the bird refused. One day, Louis was shoveling on a barge when the foreman discovered fish was missing from the galley. If the thieves didn't turn themselves in, he said, he'd report it to the bird. The culprits confessed, but the foreman, suspecting more men were involved, told the bird anyway. The bird called the work party out and ordered the thieves to stand in front. He then yanked out Wade, Tinker, Louis, and two other officers. These officers, he said, were responsible for the thieves' acts. His punishment? Each enlisted man would punch each officer and thief in the face with maximum force. The chosen men were horrified. There were some 100 enlisted men. Any POW who refused to punch the chosen men, the bird said, would also be beaten. The enlisted men had no choice. At first, some hit softly, but they were immediately clubbed by the guards, then set upon by the bird, screeching at them and forcing them to hit their victims more and more. Louis began whispering to each man to just do it and hit hard. For the first few punches, Louis stayed upright, but soon his legs wavered and he collapsed. He pulled himself up, but fell again with the next punch, and the next. Eventually he blacked out. When he woke, the bird forced the men to resume punching him, barking, "Next! Next! Next!" In Louis's whirling mind, the voice began to sound like the tramping of feet. The sun sank. For 2 hours, the beating went on. The victims had to be carried to the barracks. Louis's face was so swollen that for several days he could barely open his mouth. By Wade's estimate, each man had been punched in the face some 220 times. June 1945 became July. Every night, great forests of B-29s passed over, air raid sirens screaming their arrival. Sometimes the men could hear soft booming in the darkness. Louis was sick and demoralized. He lay on his plank, daydreaming of the Olympics, clinging to them as a shining promise. He prayed ceaselessly for rescue. His nightmares of the bird were endless. His will was fraying. The food situation was increasingly dire. With the import of the new POWs, the population had more than doubled, but the rations hadn't. Now the rations were still smaller, usually nothing but seaweed. Fall was coming, and Louis and the other POWs were scared. They were told their rations and supplies of heating fuel would be cut more in winter and might be discontinued. Many men were barely hanging on. In the barracks one day, a young POW dragged in from slave work lay down, asked Louis to wake him for dinner, and went still. At chow time, Louis kicked his foot. The man didn't move. He was dead. Few POWs in Naoetsu or anywhere else thought they'd live to see another spring. There was a worry greater still. Even in isolated Naoetsu, it was obvious Japan was staggering. Watching B-29s flying unopposed, the POWs knew Japan's air defenses were gutted, and the Americans were very close. Civilians were in shocking condition. The limbs of the adults were grotesquely swollen from beriberi. The children were gaunt. The POWs were so disturbed by the famine among civilians that they stopped stealing. Japan had long ago lost this war. But for Japan, surrender was unthinkable. If a massively destructive air bombardment couldn't end the war, invasion seemed the only possibility. POWs saw women holding sharpened sticks, practicing lunges, and small children being drilled with wooden mock guns. Japan was preparing to fight to the last man, woman, and child. Invasion seemed inevitable and imminent. The POWs, knowing of the kill-all order, were terrified. At one camp, which held 2,000 POWs,